You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 6th of August, 1921. Yesterday I wanted to show how, from the mid-19th century onward, materialism and sensualism gradually developed toward a certain culmination, which they then attained toward the end of that century, at least from a certain perspective. Let us first consider how the outward realities of human evolution took shape under the influence of the materialistic worldview. It cannot be seen as something that proceeded merely from the caprice of a number of leading individuals. You see, even if this is denied in various circles, the underlying foundations of this materialistic outlook are what enabled the scientific convictions and research results of the 19th and early 20th centuries to reach their high point. Humanity had to find its way to these scientific findings, the ground for which was laid in the 15th century, though these developments did not culminate, at least in their educative effect upon humanity, until the 19th century. As we have seen, the foundations of this scientific outlook inevitably developed into a certain materialistic worldview. Yesterday I got no further than saying that what was involved in these developments emerged in radical form, at least in their outer symptoms, in what we can characterize as the stance of Haeckel, to what then arose in opposition to him in the last decade of the 19th century and at the beginning of the 20th. We can look at what here unfolded and was incisive for general human culture, without paying heed to Haeckel's specific formulations of his worldview, or to the specific ways in which his opponents formulated their refutations of it. We need only look, on the one hand, at the belief that it was possible to encompass human nature by a thorough observation of material processes, that a worldview ought only to include such processes, and only then, as people thought, would it be reliable. This was a wholly new development compared to the content of medieval worldviews. In terms of natural science, decisive new findings have been gained over the past 3, 4, or 5 centuries, while nothing new has been discovered about the world of spirit. In the spiritual cultural realm, people had ultimately arrived at a philosophy whose chief task they saw, as I explained yesterday, in efforts to justify the very existence of this field. Theories of knowledge were written with the aim of stating that, after all, in a particular obscure area of inquiry, it was, at most, possible to assume that a supersensible world might exist, whereas the proponents of sensualism, chief among them the ingenious philosopher Zolbe, spoke of the positive nature of tangible reality. The philosophers and their popularizing pupils, on the other hand, spoke of something that immediately evaporated and eluded your grasp when you tried to get hold of it. The curious cultural historical phenomenon now arose in which Haeckel advanced his purely naturalistic edifice of the world, while the world of philosophy took issue with and contested this Haeckelianism, as we may call it. One might consider this whole problem in aesthetic terms. We could gaze upon the monumental aspect of Haeckel's work, whether it be true or false, that became apparent in his survey and summary of disparate facts whose totality gave rise to a worldview. The place of Haeckel within his era was for me very well characterized by events surrounding the celebration of his 60th birthday in Jena in the 1890s, which I attended. Of Haeckel himself, no one any longer expected anything by then. He had stated more or less all that he could state from his perspective, and by then was really merely reiterating what he had previously said. At this Haeckel celebration, a physiologist from the medical faculty spoke, and it was extremely interesting to hear what he had to say and to observe him somewhat from a spiritual perspective. There were many people present who regarded Haeckel as a highly significant and outstanding person, but this physiologist was a very conscientious university professor of a particular kind, one replaceable by any other of his kind. It would have been hard to distinguish between them, such was the uniformity of their views. Haeckel could be distinguished from all others, but this professor was indistinguishable from his colleagues, something I would beg you to see as a characteristic of the age, rather than as pertaining only to this specific instance. So he stood there pretty indistinguishable from any other of his associates, and was to speak at his Haeckel celebration. And you could say that every word he spoke revealed what was really involved here. You see, whereas some of the younger folk present spoke with a certain emphasis, in an awareness that Haeckel was an outstanding individual, they were at most associate or assistant professors in Jena, unremunerated, they had just been given an honorary title. The man I'm speaking of did not single out Haeckel in this way. If he had done, the principle of uniformity I'm referring to could not have been upheld. So he kept speaking, albeit in laudatory terms, of his colleague Haeckel. He kept using this term in every other sentence, indicating that the occasion was simply the 60th birthday of a colleague, like any other. But then he was required to actually say something in his address. Well, it's true that as this representative of the university, he belonged in the ranks of those who do nothing but gather scientific data, the same data from which Haeckel had formed his worldview. But such professors do not go beyond this gathering of data, since they do not wish to know anything about the possibility of forming a worldview. And so this colleague did not speak about Haeckel's worldview. But he praised Haeckel, from his particular perspective, in a curious way, by suggesting that quite apart from what Haeckel had asserted about the world and about life, one could appreciate what colleague Haeckel had discovered in his specialized field. There were in the university cupboards thousands of microscopic slides prepared by Haeckel relating to this and that field. And if one counted up all these purely empirical data that Haeckel had collected, compiled, and processed, this amounted to the work of a whole academy. Thus this colleague in the medical faculty implicitly contained in his one person and represented a whole number of such colleagues, all at their indistinguishable work. Then at the actual festive meal, Eucken, the philosopher, stood up to speak. Whatever he had or didn't have to say, he revealed it, or one could also say concealed it, in the guise of Haeckel's necktie, his messily tied cravat, and the complaints made by Haeckel's family when they spoke to close acquaintances about their papa or husband. The philosopher went on at length about the carelessly tied cravat, doing so with some acuity. But that was all, really, that philosophy seemed able to say about the matter. And this was pretty characteristic, in fact, since philosophy didn't really have anything else to say. Everything presented on this occasion was abstract and impenetrable. We can leave aside value judgments here, since we can also let such things act upon our aesthetic sense, and see in them something symptomatic of how materialism has surfaced in the modern era. Philosophy really has nothing more to say here, since it has become a mere adjunct to what has arisen in the course of time. Nor should we think that philosophy has anything to tell spiritual science either, this having been demonstrated by Eucken recently in the debate that was recounted in a very arresting way in the last but one issue of the title Threefolding Journal, showing that all of Eucken's volubility is in fact completely devoid of content. But let us now take the positive fact in everything I have said, and scrutinize it in terms of cultural history. On the one hand, as apparent from yesterday's reflections, humankind has developed an inward intellectualism, which scholasticism, in its thought technique, brought to the highest flowering prior to the scientific age. Then we applied this intellectualism to external science and knowledge of nature. By doing so, we brought about what we then see in the 19th century, especially toward the end of that century, as something of great historical importance. We see how intellectualism and materialism go hand in hand. If we consider this phenomenon as it relates to the nature of the human being, we have to say that of the threefold human being consisting of the neurosensory realm with the life of thought, the rhythmic realm with feeling life, and the metabolic realm with a life of will, such a worldview primarily encompasses our head organism, our neurosensory aspect. For this reason, the neurosensory realm was also most strongly developed in the 19th century. Recently, I described from another point of view how those who felt the import of this, who felt that this head aspect of the human being, this neurosensory aspect, was especially developed through 19th century culture, became fearful about the future of humanity. I described this to you in relation to a conversation I once had decades ago with the Austrian poet Hermann Rollet. Rollet certainly held a thoroughly materialistic worldview, since someone such as he, who based his outlook on science and for whom the whole old traditional ideas had grown pale and insipid, could not really think otherwise. But at the same time, since he possessed a poetic and artistic nature, he also published the beautiful work titled Images of Goethe. He felt that human nature was progressing only in terms of its neurosensory aspect, its life of thought. He wanted to give tangible expression to this, and therefore he said that human arms, feet, and legs were growing ever smaller, while the head grew ever bigger. He sought to give spatial expression to what was happening. And he said that if this were to continue, then the human being eventually, in his vividly tangible terms, would end up being nothing more than a spherical head that rolls around on the surface of the earth. You can feel the cultural anxiety that comes to expression here. But those who study such things, without spiritual scientific methods of inquiry, see only their outer aspect. If we wish to penetrate the chaos of outlooks which causes such calamity today, we also have to look at things from the other perspective. Someone might say, for instance, that the materialistic worldview that has emerged is shared by only a small minority of people, while the great majority still see and feel the world in terms of traditional faiths and confessions. Well, yes, that is true in a superficial way. But as far as all thought forms are concerned, what people think in their inmost being about the surrounding world does not bear this out. In our contemporary culture, what lives in Haeckel's world enigmas, in quotes, is not confined to those, and perhaps least confined to those, who take a direct interest in these world enigmas of Haeckel. Haeckel's world enigmas are, after all, only a symptom of the predominant feeling impulses of human beings throughout the whole civilized world. One can say that these impulses of feeling actually come to expression most characteristically in outwardly pious Christians, especially in outwardly pious Catholics. Certainly on Sundays they profess the tenets of dogma. But the way in which they live their ordinary lives during the other days of the week has found a kind of overall expression in the materialistic outlook of the 19th century. Even in the furthest flung country villages, this is very much the popular view. And so one cannot say that it is held only by a vanishingly small minority. While it is true that this small minority formulated conceptually, This is merely symptomatic of a more universal condition. What matters, the actual reality, is very much the salient characteristic of the modern age. We can study these things through their symptoms, but we also have to recognize that in the same way as, in speaking of Kant, we refer to a symptom of the second half of the 18th century, so here too, we are speaking symptomatically when referring to things I touched on yesterday and am speaking of again today. For this reason, we must give great weight to what I am about to say. A person can be intellectually active and given up to material things and phenomena, which are the counterpart of intellectualism, but this can be during the waking hours of day only, and not even entirely then. As we know, human beings not only possess a life of thought, but also a feeling life, which is inwardly equivalent to dream life. Dream life unfolds in pictures, while feeling life unfolds in feelings. But the inner, substantial aspect here is what experiences these dream images in us, what undergoes feelings in us. We can say that during waking life, from waking in the morning to falling asleep at night, a person has a waking dream in their feelings. The feelings we experience are imbued with the same degree of consciousness as dream pictures. And what we experience in our will impulses is asleep, sleeps even while we are awake. In reality, we are awake only in our life of thoughts. You fall asleep at night and wake up in the morning. If a certain spiritual scientific insight is not brought to bear on what occurs between falling asleep and waking up, this is unavailable to your awareness. You know nothing of it consciously. At most, dream images surface in your awareness, but you will regard these as of no more significance for a worldview than you would think feelings to be significant for it. In a sense, human life is always interrupted by the life of sleep. But in the same way that the life of sleep takes up a portion of time within the fullness of human soul life, so the world of feelings, and especially the world of will impulses, occupy aspects of human life. In feeling, we dream. In our will impulses, we sleep. And just as little as you know what is happening to you in sleep, so likewise you do not know what is happening. When intending to raise your arm, you then do so. The inner forces that actually hold sway there lie in an obscurity of awareness, in the same way as does the unconsciousness of sleep. And so we can say that the modern culture initiated in the 15th century, and reaching its culmination in the 19th century, only drew on a third of this threefold human being, the thinking part, the head aspect. And we have to ask what was happening, therefore, in the dreaming, feeling part of us, in the sleeping will, and what was happening in people in the periods between falling asleep and awakening. Yes, as human beings, we can be materialistic in our life of thought. Certainly we can, as the 19th century has shown. The 19th century also demonstrated the justification of this materialism, leading to positive insights into the material world, which is an image, a reflection of the world of spirit. We can be materialists with our heads, but then our dreaming life of feeling is not in our power. Our sleeping will life is not within our control. These, especially the latter, the life of will, then become spiritually inclined. It is interesting from the spiritual scientific perspective to observe what happens here. Picture someone like Moshat or Tsolba, people who, with their heads, acknowledge nothing but sensualism, materialism. Down below, they have their will aspect, with its entirely spiritual inclinations, but their head knows nothing of this, which heeds spiritual things and worlds of spirit. They have the feeling part of them which heeds ghostly apparitions. And if we rightly observe, we have the drama of the materialistic writers sitting there and utterly disparaging everything that lies as spiritual nature in his own feeling and will, growing livid because he also has a spiritualist rumbling around in him, in complete opposition to his conscious thought. That's how things have been. Idealism, spirituality, was present, especially in people's subconscious will, and the strongest spiritualists were the materialists, the sensualists. But what lives bodily in our feeling aspect? Rhythm, blood circulation, the rhythm of breathing, and so on. What lives in our will aspect? Metabolism. Let us first look at this metabolism. Whereas the head occupies itself with the clever processing of material things and material phenomena to produce a materialistic science, our metabolic aspect, which certainly also possesses the full human structure, is elaborating the diametrically opposite image of the world. It elaborates a thoroughly spiritual image of the world, which materialists, precisely, carry unconsciously within them. But in their metabolic realm, this acts upon drives and impulses. There it brings about the opposite of what it would bring about if it drew upon the whole human being. It pervades the instincts and is seized upon by aramonic powers. Not acting, therefore, in accord with divine spiritual intentions, but with aramonic spiritual intentions. It develops the instincts to the highest level of egotism. It develops the instincts in such a way that a person only gets as far as life's necessities, imperatives, without account of social impulses, social charity, and so on. Individuality is developed especially to the point of an instinctive egotism. And if I can put it like this, this inclination took shape beneath the surface of materialistic civilization, and then surfaced in world historical events, is surfacing now. What developed germinally under the surface, in the depths of human will, where spirituality seized hold of the instincts, is now surfacing in world historical events. And if evolution continues to unfold with these consequences, by the end of the 20th century we would be witnessing the war of all against all, precisely in the regions of Earth evolution in which modern civilization, as it is called, has developed. And we see what has thus developed already streaming out from the east over a large part of the earth. There are inner connections here. One need only see them. These connections are reflected outwardly as symptoms of what I have described, and as others have also observed. I have said that the views of philosophers such as Avenarius or Mach, insofar as these outlooks inform the head, are rooted in liberal and highly civically minded views of the 19th century. These are conscientious folk who cannot be reproached if we're considering 19th century morality. Nevertheless, if you read Russian authors who knew how to delineate their era, you can see the way in which philosophical outlooks, such as those of Avenarius and Mach, turned into Bolshevik state philosophy. This is not merely because high-ranking Bolshevik activists attended lectures by Avenarius in Zurich, for instance, or Adler, the pupil of Mach, but rather there are inner impulses at work here. What Avenarius propounded could, of course, be civic-minded, praiseworthily civic-minded in terms of the head. But in reality it became the basis for what spiritually inflamed instincts in humanity's subterranean depths, and then bore the corresponding practical fruits, because it certainly gave rise to these fruits. Here you see, and this is something I have to keep pointing out, the difference between true logic, a logic of reality, and a merely abstract rational logic. No one with the best will in the world, or you could also say with the worst will in the world, will be able to derive from Avenarius or Mach a Bolshevik ethics, if it can be called ethics at all. The one did not lead directly to the other in terms of any abstract logic, but in a quite different way. Living logic is something quite different from abstract logic. whatever it is we can deduce logically, does not have to arise in reality, but the very opposite can arise. That is why there is such a great difference between what people increasingly learned to trust in the materialistic age, an abstract logic of thought, which only encompasses the head, and the sense of reality, which in our time is the only thing that can lead to real benefit. In our time, people are content if a logic free of contradictions can be demonstrated in support of a particular view of the world. But actually, this signifies nothing at all. It really doesn't matter whether or not an outlook can be logically established, for basically a radical materialism can be established logically, just as well as a radical spirituality, as can every shade of outlook between them. What counts today is to recognize that something need not merely be logical, but must be both logical and in accord with reality. An accordance, attunement with reality, is achieved only by living in and with reality, something that spiritual science cultivates in us. So in terms of what I have said today, what really matters? Spiritual science has many different aspects, but in terms of what I have said today, what counts? Well, it is a matter of really drawing forth a knowledge from subterranean depths, not merely from the head, but from the whole human being. You could put it like this. A person whose perceptions and understanding have been cultivated in modern times sees the world around them as outside their skin, whereas they themselves live inside their skin. Let me draw this schematically as follows. Here is a person. Outside them is everything they reflect upon. And now they try to know something about what lies outside them. You could say they count upon the reciprocal relationship between themselves and what lies outside their skin. This stance is epitomized in the logical inquiries of John Stuart Mill or the philosophical edifice of Herbert Spencer and such like. If we rise to higher knowledge, then we are no longer concerned with the human being who inhabits their skin. For everything that thus lives in someone is reflected in the head, is only head knowledge, but with the whole human being. But the whole human being is bound up with the whole earth. Basically, the knowledge we call supersensible is not a dialogue between what lies within a person's skin and what lies beyond it, but rather between what lies within the earth and what lies outside it. As human beings, we are one with the earth, and therefore we also shed all that is bound up with one place on it, nationality, and so forth. We take the point of view of the earth being and speak from the perspective of this being about the cosmos. Try to feel what is shown from this perspective, let us say in a series of lectures such as those I gave in The Hague, where I speak about the connection between the various members of the human being with our surroundings. The real underlying intention here is focused on our union as human beings with our environment, where the view of the human being offered is not that of one moment, let us say just on the 13th May, but of how we live through all the seasons of the year, how we live in all the different localities, and so on. And precisely through such a view, we become earth beings, gaining certain insights which embody a human dialogue with what lies beyond the earth, with what lies beneath it, and only then do earthly conditions become apparent to us. Thus, spiritual science does not proceed from this narrowly circumscribed human being, from whom the intellectual, materialistic science of the 19th century proceeds, with its characteristic unbridling of asocial instincts. No, spiritual science arises from the whole human being. It brings into the foreground what only touches the separate human being in a secondary way. By this means, although it too seemingly elaborates only intellectual concepts, it has the capacity of informing these concepts with realities, ones, however, which give rise to social impulses in the place of asocial ones. Often we need to regard the world from a standpoint other than the one habitual in the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th. It was thought praiseworthy that so much has been said about social demands, about society. But with greater insight, it becomes apparent that this is only a sign of the marked degree of asocial instincts which people harbor within them. Just as those who speak a great deal about love are often not very loving, while those who speak little of it, so usually those who harp on about social concerns, as become the custom in the last third of the 19th century, are entirely pervaded by asocial impulses and instincts. The social system asserting itself in Eastern Europe is nothing other than a vivid proof of all a and anti-social life. Here let me mention in passing the reproach repeatedly made against anthroposophic spiritual science. I heard this again only very recently, that it speaks so little about God. Those particularly who harp on about God reproach anthroposophic spiritual science for mentioning God so little. As I have often said, it seems to me that people who keep talking about God forget that one of the Ten Commandments states that, quote, you should not take the name of the Lord in vain, close quote. And that keeping this commandment is far more important in a Christian sense than continually mentioning God. It may well be that it is hard to discern the real nature of what is given through spiritual observation as the ideas of spiritual science. People may think this is just a doctrine that speaks of worlds other than materialistic worlds, but this is not the case. What these ideas encompass, also without any need at all for people themselves to undergo an esoteric schooling, actually educates the human being. Above all, it does not educate the human head, but the whole human being. And it acts upon and affects this whole human being. It corrects the harm done by the spiritual adversary, who has always also lived within the sensualists and materialists themselves. Such are the secret interconnections in life. It is deeply painful to see how this adversary has been lurking within materialists of the 19th century, that is, within the great majority of people. Seeing this, we can also recognize how necessary it is that this spiritual being should now rise up from the subconscious into conscious awareness. Then he will no longer stir up human instincts in his Ahrimanic form, but will instead actually be able to found on earth a socially workable human structure amongst humankind. In other words, if things are allowed to continue, as I have described them, unfolding under the influence of the 19th century worldview, which was such an understandable development, then by the end of the 20th century, we will be witnessing the war of all against all. Whatever beautiful speeches people make, whatever scientific advances have been achieved, we would be facing the war of all against all. We would see the cultivation of a humanity that no longer possesses any social instincts, but which talks all the more about society and social matters. Human evolution needs the spiritual, consciously spiritual, life-enhancing impulse. You see, we always have to distinguish between the value that any wisdom or anything else in life possesses as such, and the value it has for humanity's evolution. Intellectualism, which belongs with materialism, has helped humanity to evolve in a way that developed the life of thought to the highest degree, initially in scholasticism, in its technique of thinking, which was the first deed of emancipation, then in the natural science of today, the second deed of emancipation. But meanwhile, something has been raging in subconscious depths, and this element has enslaved human beings in their instincts. They need to be emancipated in turn, but this can only happen if we have a science, a mode of knowledge, a spiritual worldview that has become as widespread as the materialistic outlook has so far become widespread and popularized. When we have a spiritual worldview which now establishes the counterbalance to what has so far developed through knowledge that is purely of the head. We must repeatedly regard things from this perspective. For as I said, it doesn't matter how much people harp on about the need for a new age arising from ethical outlooks, from a re-enlivening of religiosity and so forth, for nothing will actually be achieved in this way. This only indulges and promotes the mendacity of the age. We have to recognize, rather, that something seemingly theoretical, such as that the earth evolved through the stages of moon, sun, and Saturn, must enter and inform the human soul. For if properly understood and absorbed, this spiritualizes human beings right into their moral and religious impulses. Just as little as you can build anything real in the outer world by merely wishing, however well-meaning your wishes may be, so you cannot build anything in the world of society by simply admonishing people to be good, by pious sermons. The world-destroying impulses at work today did not arise by random human actions, but as a consequence of the worldview that has arisen since the beginning of the 15th century. The counterpole to these impulses, the thing that can heal the wounds that have been inflicted, will be and has to be a different worldview. And we ought not to shy away in cowardly fashion from standing up for a worldview that possesses a moral power, the power to make religion real. For this is the only thing that can bring healing. Anyone who discerns this whole context will gain a sense of something that people always possessed whenever they possessed a little true wisdom. I have spoken of ancient mystery centers, and you can read about this in anthroposophic literature, as a part of spiritual science. Here you will see how an ancient instinctive wisdom developed and then slowly transformed into the intellectual, materialistic outlook of modern times. But even if we look back to the more exoteric sciences of ancient times, say to Hippocrates in the field of medicine, not to mention a still more ancient medical outlook in the Egyptian era, we find that a doctor is always also a philosopher. It is more or less inconceivable for a doctor not to be at the same time a philosopher, and a philosopher at the same time a doctor, and a priest to be likewise both. Anything else was inconceivable then. Why? Let us consider a truth I have often referred to. At the moment of death, as we know, we lay aside the physical body, and the spirit reconnects very strongly with the world of spirit. But that is only one moment. I'll put it like this. There are infinitely many incremental stages contained in the moment of death, which always exist within us during our whole life. We are dying continually. We start dying the moment we are born. And at every moment a minute dying process is at work in us. We could not think, we could conceive of a great part of our soul life, and above all spiritual life, if we did not continually have death within us. Death is at work in us all the time, and when we can't carry on anymore, we die at a particular moment. In this way we are dying continually from birth onward. Now a more ancient instinctive wisdom felt that human life is really a slow dying. Heraclitus, who lived somewhat after the era of primordial wisdom, expressed it like this. Human life is dying. Human feeling is a continual sickness. We have the tendency for death and sickness. So what is the purpose of what we learn? It must be a kind of medicine. Learning must be a process of healing. Having an outlook, a world view, must be a process of healing. Doctors back then certainly had this sense of things, and only tried to cure people in a material sense when it was really necessary, when the illness was acute. But they saw human life as a kind of chronic disease, and a philosopher or doctor felt himself to be a healer for earthly humanity, as a healer for what is now commonly regarded as normal, but is in fact sick, is a predisposition for dying. These feelings are ones we need to reintegrate into our outlook, since they are not merely a filling of head, of mind, a filling with knowledge, but a real living process. We must come to see that an outlook, a worldview, can serve to heal humanity. Actually, at this current stage of cultural historical evolution, we are not only slowly ailing, but are in the midst of an acute cultural sickness. Whatever now arises as worldview must become a real medicine, a true medical science, a cure. We need to imbue ourselves with the true meaning and consequences of the worldview I'm referring to for contemporary civilization and culture. We must be imbued with the sense that a worldview is actually a reality, not merely a formality that consists of the desire to know things, to form concepts for external matters, to acquaint oneself with natural laws and apply them as technology. No, this inwardness, this real connection with human life and existence, must be present in a true worldview so that real and necessary remedies can be gained from it for the illnesses afflicting us. Indeed, for the process of dying at work in us. As long as people fail to speak in these terms and fail to understand such things, they will just go on talking about the ills of the era rather than of what is needed to address them. Tomorrow we will speak further on these things. The end of Lecture 5.